This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Well, good afternoon to everybody. You know, we've been talking a lot on this show over the last couple of months about Veterans Affairs and about what's happening to our veterans in this country, lack of proper medical treatment, and the situation with their Second Amendment rights. And so today I have on the show a good friend of mine who is very, very versed on Veterans Affairs and who is a veteran himself. His name is Alan Clark. He's a 1963 West Point graduate. He served in Vietnam as a military intelligence officer involved in undercover intelligence operations against Cambodia. He was assigned to the 5th Special Forces Group, Green Berets. On June 17, 1967, he was severely wounded in a mortar attack at Dak Tho Special Forces Camp in the Central Highlands of South Vietnam. He was in the hospital for 15 months and for treatment, and this was after the amputation of both of his legs below his knees. He was awarded the Silver Star for gallantry in action, the Purple Heart, Bronze Star, Air Medal, and Combat Infantryman's Badge. He was airborne qualified, just like my two sons who are currently serving are. And then Alan went on after that to work in Veterans Affairs on both the state level and the state of Texas. He was special assistant to Texas Governor Bill Clemens from 1979 to 1981, and he was nominated by George H.W. Bush and confirmed twice by the Senate, once Assistant Secretary for Veterans Liaison and Program Coordination, and is Director of the National Cemetery System of the Department of Veterans Affairs. But the most important thing, what I want to talk to Alan about today, is his work with wounded veterans, our wounded warriors, and the veterans around the country. And he has his own website called www.combatfaith.com, and he has a blog on that. And Alan, thank you for coming on the show, and tell people about your website.
Well, thank you very much. Several years ago, I left the VA. I retired in 05, and I had met so many hurting veterans with post-traumatic stress, Michael. And I had my own bout with post-traumatic stress in the sense that in about the eighth month of my 15-month stay in 68, I just cratered. You know, I had the original post-traumatic stress disorder, and I was scared about my future, worried about life, transitioning to civilian life. And so my own story is kind of an example of what starts to happen to you when you come back from combat, wounded especially in body and soul and spirit as I was. So I went to a closed psychiatric ward for 14 weeks at Brooke General Hospital and then saw a psychiatrist and pills for 6 years. In 75 or so, I got my faith act together by going to a church and understanding the big picture spiritually, and I haven't had to have pills or psychiatrist since about that time. So I have, between working at the VA for so long at the local hospital level here in Dallas and also at the national level with policy and meeting dozens of vets, having my own issues, I really can work with vets and analyze them. And so I put a lot of stuff on that website, combatfaith.com. I personally visit with vets on telephone or by email or by messages and so forth, and I send them copies of my book, or they buy my book and they contact me. So I really, you know, try to help them heal from the emotional and soulful issues of post-traumatic stress.
Well, you do great work, and your first book, Wounded Warrior, Soldier, Healing Warrior, I have read that book. That was published back in 2007. It's a remarkable story, and I would recommend it to everybody. That's Wounded Soldier, Healing Warrior. And you can find information on that about that on your website. And I think you've also done a YouTube video, which people can access through your website. Tell us about that book. It's your autobiography, and what do you tell folks there?
Well, you know, I started writing it in the early 70s. I'd go to, you know, just people's living rooms, and I would tell them anecdotes about my time in Vietnam and so forth and my healing process, and they began to flatter me, I should say, and say, well, you ought to write a book, Alan. So I began to write a book, and I just kept living a new chapter of my life, getting healed, working for the governor of Texas, working in Washington at the national level and everything. So eventually I retired from the government and had time after being at the VA in 05 and retired, and I got the book published, and it has done very, very well. Thousands of copies have been sold. I sell copies myself from my home. People want it, you know, to be personalized, and then it's on Amazon also. And a lot of people tell me that it's really been helpful to them in the sense of explaining how you can be severely disabled in combat and yet recover and kind of get your faith act together and move on with your life and have a few other satisfying parts of your life, which I've had. And so I guess that's the success of the book, is it tells a war story, a healing story, and a faith walk story, and a move on, get past your issues through your faith walk.
Well, in the last couple of years, you've written a second book called Valor in Vietnam, Chronicles of Honor, Courage, and Sacrifice, 1963 to 1977. And tell my listeners about that book.
Yeah, well, I originally, when I was at the VA, I knew so many veterans. And I ran across, beginning, you know, 10, 15 years ago at the hospital, a lot of World War II vets that had wonderful stories. And I started to think about writing a book with World War II stories. But my friends started either dying off, unfortunately, because I mean, getting into their 80s and so forth, or they were losing their memory relative to what they thought about. So I said, well, look, Vietnam is something I know a lot about, know a lot of Vietnam vets, and we're still in our late 50s or 60s when I started this about 7 or 8 years ago. So let me do that book. So I started collecting stories, and people would recommend other stories. They say, well, you know, you ought to call so and so. So this book is stories beginning in 1963 with the special forces camps that were set up along the border to find out about the infiltration of the communists down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And then I have a story which is really a very incredible story about the probable provocation for why the Gulf of Tonkin happened at all, because the North Vietnamese reacted to something we were doing. So I have that story. But I have Marine stories, Air Force stories, Navy stories, Army stories, an Army nurse story, a civilian story. So it's 19 chapters. It covers all the areas of the country. It covers all the branches of the military, plus a nurse, plus the civilian. And goes all the way from 63 to 77, 2 years after the war. There's a story about a woman who was in love with an American and got out of Vietnam safely with a couple of her children and came back and married him in the United States.
Tell us some of the other stories in there, because the book is remarkable. I've read it,
well,
too,
yeah,
and I highly recommend both of these books to the people listening. And but tell us a few more stories out of that book.
Yeah. Well, by the way, before I miss this, I must say that I am so pleased that there is an e-book on Amazon and maybe on Barnes & Noble Nook, but on the Kindle, you can get Valor in Vietnam as an e-book at $1.99, fire sale. And it is the number one selling e-book for Vietnam War stories, and it's the number two book for history, for United States, you know, world history stories. So it's just amazing how it's, for 3 weeks, it's been number one for Vietnam War stories. Well, I have a story about a very secret organization called Military Advisory Command Studies and Observation Group. They're the ones that parachuted South Vietnamese anti-communists into the North during the war. I don't have a whole lot about that because that started after this story. But the colonel that started this unit commanded units of South Vietnamese Marines and Navy that would go into North Vietnam on raids, what they call cross beach raids. And they kept ratcheting that up in 1964. And eventually they got so far north in such a heavy raid, that's when the communists sent their little boats out to attack one of our ships, and that precipitated the Gulf of Tonkin. And then I have stories going from a very celebrated case that the United States Army people know about, a West Pointer who was the lonesome end for the Army football team in the late 50s, and he was surrounded and almost obliterated by the communists. So a personal friend of mine took a company up and rescued him. So I've got that story. I have a story of an Air Force pilot who, very little is known, that there were three Russian bombers that came down on a raid into South Vietnam and didn't do any damage, but went back to their base. So the United States Air Force decided, well, we're not going to let these communists have a part in coming down, and we control the air. So he sent a mission with two airplanes, fighter bombers, into North Vietnam to the base where these three Russian bombers were located. And this man, who's a major general retired that lives in the Dallas area, is a personal friend of mine, and he told the specific story about unloading his bombs and hit the first plane on the ground. He circled around after being hit and unloaded his other bombs on the other planes. They took out two of the three, got into Laos, and he had to bail out. And so he's on the ground, and the communists sent a patrol to get him, and he was lifted up by one of our Jolly Green Giants and was saved. So I have that story. And then I have a story as an example of what they call the Brown Water Navy, which was the small PT boat, the small boats along the rivers in the Mekong Delta down in the south, and then in some of the tributaries along the coast also. But a story about that and what they did. A nurse, fantastic, amazing story about being an Army nurse at a hospital in Da Nang for a year. And she was in the same hospital that was in that TV series called China Beach that some people may remember. And, you know, what she went through. And it was just so hard for a young woman in her early 20s to be in a place like that and seeing all the horror and the suffering of taking care of the wounded people coming from the battlefield into that hospital before evacuation back to the United States. And then a civilian that worked on special projects to try to use propaganda on behalf of the government of South Vietnam to keep the people in the villages, you know, revved up to be supporting the government. And a Marine officer was involved with something called the Operation Phoenix, which was run by the CIA, and was a very fascinating program, which was very secret at the time. But, you know, it's not secret anymore. But he's another personal friend of mine that lives in the Dallas area, and I tell that story. And then people that know history about Vietnam will probably remember what's called the San Tae Raid in 1970 at a prison camp near Hanoi that was thought to hold American prisoners. Well, as it turns out, they did the raid. They took out the people at the guard towers, got on the ground. Prisoners had been moved. But the Americans came back out, and they were rescued, you know, pulled out by choppers. So tell that story. And then one of the most poignant stories is the evacuation from Saigon, which was in the spring of 1970, basically March and April. So I have a Special Forces a captain who was a friend of mine that is now deceased, George Petrie, who was in charge of getting the people out of downtown Saigon, civilians that had helped us, American civilians and military people and so forth. There weren't very many of those left, but get them out of the country on airplanes from Tan Son Nhut Air Base, and then the helicopter operation to evacuate the embassy. And, you know, that was a very celebrated historical event for the evacuation of Saigon. It was finished on April 30th. So, like I say, it goes from 63 with the Special Forces camps through a lot of action with Marines on the ground, Army on the ground, Navy ship, Navy pilot, Air Force helicopter pilot, Air Force fighter bomber pilot, several celebrated and well-known cases with people that were involved, and then finishes up with that woman who was on the grounds of the embassy when the last helicopter took off. She was there with a couple of her kids and was ready to get on a helicopter, and they said goodbye, and they took that last helicopter off the roof of the embassy. It was an amazing book to write.
Well, we need to take our first break, Alan, but we'll talk some more after the break.
Okay.
The United States Justice Foundation, since 1979, has been dedicated to instructing, informing, and educating the public on legal issues confronting America. That means you and me. When necessary, this nonprofit organization has had to litigate to present the constitutional view. Since 1980, USJF has submitted testimony to the U.S. Senate on all but one U.S. Supreme Court nominee. Learn more about USJF by visiting their website at www.usjf.net. Support this nonprofit as it defends our rights, our liberty, and our Constitution.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Who is or what is USJF? It is a nonprofit legal organization founded to protect our rights through the U.S. Constitution. Active in educating the public, USJF has also contributed directly and indirectly to legal defense efforts in many celebrated cases involving fundamental conservative principles. Cases of note include the Mount Soledad Cross case, the Arizona immigration law case, the Obama eligibility cases, the NDAA illegal detention issue, and many more. Help this nonprofit as they help you. Visit www.usjf.net today.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back, everybody. My guest today is Alan Clark, a good friend of mine here in Dallas, who is a West Point graduate, 1963, served in Vietnam with the Green Berets and lost both of his legs in a mortar attack, and has written several books and has worked with veterans and worked in Veterans Affairs for years and is very knowledgeable, I can tell you, not only in that area but in other areas, because Alan and I belong to a group of people that's made up mostly of veterans, and we meet periodically and talk about issues relating to veterans and issues related to our country. I would highly recommend both of Alan's books, Wounded Warrior, Healing Warrior, Wounded Soldier, excuse me, Healing Warrior, and his second book, Valor in Vietnam, Chronicles of Honor, Courage, and Sacrifice, 1963 to 1977. The stories in that book remind me of many of the stories I heard from my fellow service members back during the Vietnam War, and they're very important. And one statistic that I recently heard, Alan, I don't know if you've heard about it, but this came to me as commander of the American Legion Post in Carrollton, Texas, and I was terribly shocked by it, and that is that out of the about 1.5 million men and women who actively served in Vietnam, in country, 75% are now dead. And this is very disturbing to me because that's the highest attrition rate, the fastest attrition rate of any of our military veterans in of any war in history. Have you heard about that? And if so, what do you think about it?
Well, I have heard that. I'm not sure that's a statistic that's a quote from the government, and not that you can believe government statistics anymore. But I have heard something like that, but not from official sources to my knowledge. And, you know, so I can't confirm nor deny it, you know, as far as its credibility. But, you know, we have had a lot of our people that have just kind of dropped out, much less committed suicide, much less just withdrawn. I mean, they're just so sad and angry about what happened in Vietnam to them, you know, coming back with a vocal minority of the population being very much against us. You know, the communists had an operation in the United States of propaganda where they would, you know, they would foment those parades and those marches in the Capitol. It was the communists behind that, you know, to make it think that the American people were against the war. And, you know, many people are against the war. They're against the war today. But the difference today is they support the warrior and not the war. For us, they didn't support the war nor the warrior. And that really demoralized so many of us that, you know, we have really been upset with the country. And, you know, I'm okay because, you know, it's a bunch of stupid people as far as I'm concerned that didn't support us because we were doing our duty that we were ordered to do. But, you know, they were really demoralized. But I can't attest to that statistic.
Well, you know, I know they were demoralized because I had a lot of friends that served in Vietnam. I wore the uniform of an American soldier during that period. I can remember being spit on for no reason other than the fact that I wore the uniform. And that was certainly something that people had to suffer through, particularly those who had made the sacrifice of going overseas. And most of the people, and this is contrary to the popular history books and this sort of thing, that talk about the fact that they claim that we lost, the U.S. military lost the war in Vietnam. In fact, the U.S. military never lost a battle in Vietnam. We had won the war on two different occasions. We essentially won it, and our politicians gave it away. And, you know, we talk about the suffering of the Vietnam veterans, and tell us more about your work with them, because I know you've worked with a lot of veterans over the years.
Yeah, well, it's not just Vietnam vets, but, you know, vets all the way back to World War II. And I have on my website, combatfaith.com, specific anecdotes that I have derived from all the different wars, to include the most current wars. And I talk to vets constantly. You know, I had an extended conversation just a week ago with an Iraqi vet. And the issues that we face as warriors and as veterans is we have issues from our life before the war, before military service, during the war, and then after the war. And, you know, all these issues are issues that need to be healed. Now, for my sake, I have to be candid with you, Michael, and with everybody out there. I cannot mince words. I learned in the middle 70s to really believe that Jesus was the Christ, is the Christ. I believed that if I believe that, and that I believe in the power of prayer, and I have a faith that I'm going to live eternally, which I do, because I believe that Jesus is the Christ, that he died for my sins. And if I buy into the New Testament lessons, which is that my sins can be forgiven, that if I forgive others, I will be forgiven, that if I keep my life straight, that that I can have a strong, satisfying, comfortable life. I mean, there may be issues that hit me, whatever, and political issues and governmental issues and pain and sorrow and suffering anyway, but my basics of my life can be straightened out. That's the route that I took. That's the road that I took. And I got my life together and was able to stop seeing a psychiatrist. I forgave people that had hurt me. I tried to give up bitterness and anger toward anybody else. I kept my sins and misdoings confessed all the time. So I keep myself straight spiritually, and that means that I have a calmer life, and I just given up all these things that have happened. And I talk to the troops about that. I take individual issue by individual issue and try to take the spiritual approach to help them address the issues, get healed, and move on with their life to be good husbands, to be good wives, to be good parents, and to be good employees in their organizations and be loyal still to the country.
Well, faith is such an important part of that, what you're doing, and I think that a lot of our veterans respond positively to that. I know both of my sons who are currently serving, the oldest boy is back in Afghanistan at the moment, and he's been in combat zones a total of 102 months since 9/11. And my youngest is a Black Hawk pilot, and their faith has sustained them through some of the things that they've gone through, particularly my oldest boy, who's had a number of close calls, and I can remember him at one point talking to me about the fact that during the original invasion of Iraq, he had to preside over the burial of an 8-year-old girl who was actually killed when she and other children were used as shields by the personal bodyguard of Saddam Hussein, and they were trying to keep the Americans from shooting at him. And so, you know, he's gone through some tough things, and
sure,
the faith is very important. And but one thing I wanted to ask you about, too, is you had PTSD, and you dealt with it, and you counseled many warriors, wounded warriors who are dealing with it, or even some that have not been wounded who deal with it. And, of course, it's not even classified as a mental illness. I do not consider it a mental illness. But PTSD is something that has really come to the forefront. And one of the things that disturbs me greatly, and maybe you can give us some insight on this, is the number of veterans who are, and even active duty military personnel, who are committing suicide. It seems to be a much, much larger group than ever before. And I'm very concerned about this and trying to deal with this for the U.S. Justice Foundation. What's your take on this? What do you think is the cause of that?
Sure. Well, let me work back a little bit before the suicides. Number one, all of us that have been in combat have some issue with post-traumatic stress. The issue when we come back, does it make us dysfunctional? Does it make us try to drown our sorrow in drugs or drinking or perverse behavior, immoral behavior, or multiple marriages, or can't keep a job. So then we become dysfunctional, and then perhaps we get the D, the disorder, attached to it by a diagnosis by a psychiatrist and get compensation from the VA. But we all have PTS. The issue is that we become dysfunctional, so it becomes a disorder, and then there's certain issues that you need to satisfy with a psychiatrist to get adjudicated, to get compensation, which is tax-free income. Okay. What I understand, Michael, is that more than half of the suicides of the people in active duty military have not been deployed. So it's not like they've gone to the war zone and come back. It's that more than half aren't even related to this post-traumatic stress from the combat zone. They have issues from life. Now, you know, say, well, were they scared because they were going to be deployed? Well, I don't know how many of those are. I don't know if they've done a study on that. But so many have not even been deployed, and they're dealing with issues from their childhood, from before they went in the military. Maybe they have issues with money before they ever go, or issues with their family. So there's a whole lot of different issues out there. It may be a malaise of spirit related to the society rather than anything special with the military.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, because it you know, society certainly, we have, a lot of people have lost their faith. There are constant attacks on our faith, and I'm talking about the faith, not just Christians, but Jews and others in our society. We're being attacked for the things that we believe, and we're being told that what we believe is irresponsible and wrong. And, of course, you and I both know different. And so, you know, I can see how that would be affecting members of our military.
Sure.
And how can, if somebody wants to talk to you, if some veterans out there who are listening to this show, and I know I have a lot of them listening to it, if they would like to talk to you and find out more about what you can do for them, through the combatfaith.com. Is that the way for them to go, to contact you there?
Yeah, combatfaith.com, and spend some time navigating through the website, because I have an awful lot of information there about warfare and about coming back from the war, the issues we deal with, anecdotes and issues relative to the faith as a Christian that I've learned and put on the website. But they can also email me at my name, Alan, A-L-L-E-N, B as in boy, Clark, C-L-A-R-K, at AOL.com. Email me first and kind of give me a little bit of a background. And then if they want me to just email them, I'll respond. Or if they want to leave their phone number, I'll call them up.
And you do a lot of this, as I understand it. And
I do. Well, yeah. I spend a lot of time emailing or on the telephone, or depending upon where they live, you know, close to where I live, I'll go have a cup of coffee with them or something like that.
And, of course, you do a lot of work on the issues involving this country as a whole and our military issues and everything. I know
because I've studied,
on a lot of these.
Yeah, I've studied the internal national security threat from these rabid Islamists in the country, the jihadists, and so forth. I've studied that also.
Yeah, well, you know, that's something else that I need to have you on to talk about sometime and go into more detail about the things that you and I are learning and the things that we're studying and finding out about this. And, you know, our time is just about up. But, again, tell people how they can, the names of your books and how they can order them.
Yeah, well, my autobiography is Wounded Soldier, Healing Warrior. It's on Amazon and bookstores. And Valor in Vietnam is a hardback only that's available. But the e-book, Valor in Vietnam, is $1.99, very, very low price, obviously. Combatfaith.com is my website. It has a little bit about both the books. And you can read the reviews if you go to Amazon, as an example. And combatfaith.com, you know, you click on it and you can read a lot about the faith walk personally that I had and that I succeeded through to get out of my funk, you know, and the disorder that I had. And I hope that people can use it and get to it.
Well, thank you, Alan. I really appreciate you being on today, and I'd love to have you on again.
Well, thank you so much. It was a privilege, and I just pray that God's blessings be upon our soldiers and military that are hurting out there. Thank you very much, Mike.
You bet. Take care.
Bye.
The United States Justice Foundation, since 1979, has been dedicated to instructing, informing, and educating the public on legal issues confronting America. That means you and me. When necessary, this nonprofit organization has had to litigate to present the constitutional view. Since 1980, USJF has submitted testimony to the U.S. Senate on all but one U.S. Supreme Court nominee. Learn more about USJF by visiting their website at www.usjf.net. Support this nonprofit as it defends our rights, our liberty, and our Constitution.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like. You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Well, you know, I hope people will order copies of the books that written by Alan Clark, because he's a remarkable individual, very good friend of mine, and somebody who believes in this country, who sacrificed a lot. Can you imagine? Back in 1967, he lost both legs below his knees. Yet to see the man in action now, and to listen to him talk, and to see him work with veterans and active duty military is just an incredible thing. And, of course, the veteran situation, is, as I pointed out at the beginning of the show, is getting more and more precarious. Our veterans are being hammered right now by the VA, by the Obama administration, by other government entities, even by some local and state governments. Our veterans are, many of them are homeless. Many of them are not getting the help they needed. Obama administration is in the process of cutting veterans' benefits, forcing them to pay more for the medical care that they need. And this includes our badly wounded warriors. I mean, Obamacare, let's look at what it does. You have that medical device tax, and that includes artificial limbs. The VA is not going to pay for the tax on those. The tax is very high, and it's going to get higher because it's putting many Americans out of their jobs and putting the businesses that make those artificial limbs out of work here. They're transferring their operations to foreign countries, and so they're going to be probably selling the products for higher rates. And so, you know, we have wounded warriors out there who have lost a limb, or in some cases two or three or even four limbs, and they're being told that you have to pay the federal government in order to get the artificial limbs you need. You have to pay the same federal government that you fought for, the same country that you swore allegiance to, took the oath of office that I took and David took and Alan took to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That same group that you took that oath to, that same country, is now going to charge you for the privilege of having an artificial limb, even after you lost that limb or lost your limbs in combat fighting for this country. That's unconscionable. That's something that I'm having a tough time dealing with. I'm having a tough time dealing with the fact that our active duty military, their benefits are being cut. The commissaries are going to be cut down in the continental United States. Now, what are the commissaries? Well, most people don't even know that in the military, on military bases, they have grocery stores. And essentially, they sell other items, too, that military families need. Now, your average military family is not making a lot of money. Your enlisted men and women in the military are making less than they could probably be making outside in the civilian world. They're making less than your average school teacher, less than your police officers, less than your fire department members, who also serve us very, very ably. But the American military, they have to support their families on sometimes a little over $20,000 a year. And, yes, they do get some benefits, some housing benefits, although the government is in the process of taking a lot of that away. But one of their benefits is having the commissary. And at the commissary, what they do is they can buy groceries at about 30% less than they would pay if they go to a civilian grocery store, even Walmart. Well, the Department of Defense has decided that they're going to do away with that. Now, it's not going to only affect families, military families, by increasing the cost of their food that they put on the table, but also a large number of military spouses supplement the income of their soldier, sailor, marine, or airman by working in these commissaries. They are going to lose their jobs. So it's a double-edged sword. It's basically pounding our military members and telling them that you are not worthy to receive the benefits that we promised you when you signed up. Education benefits are being cut. All of the things that have induced people to help induce people to write that blank check to the United States saying basically we will give our all. We will give whatever is necessary, including our lives, to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That is being lost. That is being taken away from our soldiers, and they don't deserve it. And they certainly don't deserve what we've been talking about as far as their Second Amendment rights. They fought for the Constitution. They continue, as I do, to believe in that oath that we took to the Constitution. We didn't take an oath to the President of the United States, to an individual. We took an oath of office. We took an oath to his office, to his constitutional function. We took an oath to the Constitution itself. We did not take an oath to any individual who might be serving in that office or any individuals who might be serving in Congress or any other capacity in the U.S. government. We took an oath to our country, and we believe in that oath. And now the things that we fought for are being stripped away, not only from the civilian population, but particularly from the veterans. The all-out push to disarm Americans, to take away our Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, that all-out push is coming through the VA from the Obama administration. And believe me, I've got overwhelming evidence that this has originated in the Obama administration. The push started in 2009 after he took office, and a lot of the directives are coming directly from the White House to the VA to use any means necessary, including unconstitutional means, to deny the Fifth Amendment rights to our veterans, to deny them due process, and to take away their right to own firearms. This is a test case. If they are successful, they are also going to be doing the same thing to the civilians in this country. So exactly what are they doing? Well, we talked about it before, but let's briefly go over it again. Veterans are getting letters saying that because of your mental or physical disabilities, the VA is going to declare you incompetent to handle your own financial affairs. Once you're declared incompetent, you can no longer own, purchase, possess, transport firearms or ammunition. If you do, you'll be charged with a felony under the Brady Act. There's no due process here. The fiduciary program, which is what this is, to declare a veteran incompetent to handle their own affairs and appoint a fiduciary to represent them, that's been around for a number of years. But it was designed for elderly veterans who might be suffering from dementia or for some other reason were unable to take their benefits they received from the government and successfully pay their bills and keep their lives going. So the program itself is not bad. But in 2009, they started accelerating the program to include not just veterans suffering from dementia, not just elderly veterans, but to include veterans with PTSD. And Alan and I just talked about PTSD. It is not a mental illness. Yet they are classifying it as a mental illness to declare veterans incompetent. depression is not necessarily a mental illness unless it somehow is very severe. Veterans with minor depression, they may have told somebody in the VA that, you know, I was in Afghanistan, I was in Iraq, I lost a buddy in combat, I've been depressed about that, or I came home and I lost my, you know, couldn't find a civilian job, or my spouse divorced me, or somebody in my family, I lost my father or mother unexpectedly. They tell the VA that, you know, I'm depressed over it, as we would all be. That triggers the declaration of incompetency and the taking away of the Second Amendment rights. We have veterans, and I can prove this because I've seen the documents, we have veterans who have been told they're incompetent because they let the spouses pay the family bills. We have one couple I've talked to that they are in a situation where the wife works, and the man is a veteran, the husband is a veteran, the wife works in a bank. So she has everything automated. Everything is set up so that the money to pay their bills comes out of the banking account every month automatically. The veteran was told that because of this, he is being declared incompetent to handle his own financial affairs. And they're expanding it. We have a widow of a man killed in Vietnam who has been receiving veterans benefits for years. She goes into the VA one day, and they ask her, how do you handle paying your bills? And she says, it's easy. Everything is automated. It all comes out of my checking account every month. I've seen a letter where they tell her that because of that, and for that reason only, she has been declared incompetent. A fiduciary has been appointed to represent her. She can no longer own a firearm. She has to turn in her firearms if she owns any, as all these veterans are basically being told to do. And now we're hearing, and we're trying to, they haven't put this in writing yet, but apparently the VA is telling the family members of veterans that because you have a family member, because you live with a veteran who has been declared incompetent, not only can that veteran not own a firearm, but you can't own a firearm. So they're expanding the program all the time. The bottom line is we have an estimated 159,000 veterans out there who are now on the NICS list. That's the National Criminal Instant Background Checklist that prohibits these people from legally purchasing a firearm. Now, what's the criteria for being on that list? The legal criteria is to be a convicted felon, a known drug abuser, or been adjudicated to be mentally ill to the point of being a danger to yourself or others. That's not what they're doing. They're not using that criteria. They're not adjudicating anybody. There's no due process here. If they declare a veteran, they're going to be tell a veteran they're going to be declared incompetent. The burden of proof is then on the veteran to prove he or she is not incompetent. They have to do that at their own expense. They have to hire their own psychiatrist or doctor to examine them. And by the way, apparently 95% of these cases, it's some bureaucrat that's declaring the veterans incompetent. Most of these veterans have never seen a psychiatrist in the VA system. Some of them have never seen a psychologist. It's simply a word that might be written in their records that says, so-and-so, this veteran suffered from depression on this particular date. All that's being declared mental illnesses. PTSD is not a mental illness, but it's being used to disarm veterans and their families. Depression is being used. Letting the spouse handle the family bills is being used. What's going to be next? I have talked to veterans who are being told that they have to answer the question, do you own a firearm, when they go to the VA? Now we'll take our final break and talk about that more in a minute.
The United States Justice Foundation, since 1979, has been dedicated to instructing, informing, and educating the public on legal issues confronting America. That means you and me. When necessary, this nonprofit organization has had to litigate to present the constitutional view. Since 1980, USJF has submitted testimony to the U.S. Senate, on all but one U.S. Supreme Court nominee. Learn more about USJF by visiting their website at www.usjf.net. Support this nonprofit as it defends our rights, our liberty, and our Constitution.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Yeah, what's happening to our veterans is with the Second Amendment rights and Fifth Amendment rights is, again, unconscionable. And at the United States Justice Foundation, we are trying to do something about it, and we are doing something about it. We sent, and I mentioned this before on the show, we sent Freedom of Information Act request to the VA. Number one, we wanted to know on what criteria are they using to declare veterans incompetent? Because they're obviously not using the criteria that's in the law. Not when you're taking PTSD and that sort of thing and using it. They refused to answer that. We asked them a second question, that was, by what legal authority are you taking veterans, declaring them incompetent, and then turning their names into the FBI to be put on the NICS list? They refused to answer that, too. We filed a lawsuit, and we won. Basically, the judge has ordered them to turn over information to us. We haven't gotten all of it we asked for yet, but we've gotten a lot. And the information includes some memorandums and this sort of thing that specifically talk about ways that they can avoid Fifth Amendment rights to due process in order to declare veterans incompetent and put them on the next list. Just unbelievable. So because we won that lawsuit, we're getting information we need for another lawsuit. And I know I've been talking about this for quite some time, but we're having difficulty raising the money we need to file the second lawsuit. We're out there beating the bushes. I'm going around and asking people to hold little fundraising get-togethers in their homes where I can talk to people. I'm making speeches, not only in Texas, but in other parts of the country. I'm doing numerous radio interviews besides my own show. I'm talking about this issue on almost a daily basis. And we're starting to get some money trickling in, but please, if you want to help us in these lawsuits, we figure the one we want to file now. And I'm actually going to be drawing up the pleadings this week. And if there's a veteran out there in Texas who has this problem and wants to be represented at no cost, please let me know, because I'd love to file this suit in Texas so I can be the lead counsel on the case. But in any case, if you're a veteran, go to usjf.net. Let us know what your situation is. We will get back to you and get more information and see what we can do to help. Also, if you would like to donate, you can go to usjf.net, and at the top of the page, you can find out how to donate to us to help these lawsuits go forward. And we estimate between $250,000 and $500,000, because we don't intend to charge the veterans or their families anything. We may be able to do it fairly quickly. What we're probably going to do is go after an injunction and ask that the courts order the VA to stop doing what they're doing, and that is using a faulty criteria to declare veterans incompetent and then putting them on the list of people that cannot purchase firearms. We're going to ask specifically that be stopped. Now, this is the last hope of the veterans out there, because the fact of the matter is that twice the United States Senate has tried to block this. Once in 2013, when they tried to, for the 2013 National Defense Authorization Act, there was an amendment offered, and this was actually back in 2012 when the amendment was offered. The amendment was offered to stop the VA from doing this to veterans, denying them their Second Amendment rights. The Obama administration came out and opposed it, and the Democrats voted against it, and it was defeated. last year, after I wrote the original blog article on this, and it came out on my blog at www.michaelconnelly.jigsy.com, the senator from North Carolina, Richard Barr, introduced legislation to what we call the Veterans Second Amendment Protection Act. It made it to the Senate floor, but again, Obama opposed it, and the Democrats opposed it, so it was defeated. So this court case is the last best hope for our veterans. And make no mistake here, you must understand that this is a test case. It is part of the process to disarm the American people entirely. There are 21 million veterans out there. We all took the same oath of office. We were all trained to fight for our country, to fight for our Constitution, to fight for our fellow Americans and our fellow soldiers. We were trained to do that. We know how to do it, and we're still willing to do it. Many of us are armed, so they have to disarm us. And it follows a pattern, the historical pattern. When Adolf Hitler was elected Chancellor of Germany, he took several steps to try to consolidate his power and become a dictator. The first step was to nationalize the healthcare system. He felt like if he could control the access to healthcare, he could control the population. The second thing he did was to start disarming the German population, beginning with the veterans, because the German soldiers who had fought in World War I had basically taken the same type of oath of office that we take in the United States military. They had taken an oath to defend their country's constitution and defend their country, not to defend any individual or group of individuals. So he wanted to disarm those people, and then once he got that done, he started expanding it to the civilian population. Of course, the third thing he did was then he started to purge the German military of high-ranking officers who were loyal to their country and to their oath and not necessarily personally loyal to Hitler. Does that sound familiar? And then the last thing he did, well, not the last, but the next thing he did, was to start using mental illness as a way not only to disarm people but to silence opposition. Because, see, if you have somebody declared mentally ill, you take them and you put them in an institution or you put them in a camp. You don't have to go through a court system. You don't have to charge them with a crime. You don't have to have a trial. They're not entitled to an attorney. You just pick them up and they disappear. That is the next step in this country. We already have the federal government using PTSD as a mental illness. Now we have Obama, who believes that he is already a dictator and does not have to go through the congressional mandates regarding changing of laws or amending of laws, that he can simply do it on his own. Article 2 of the Constitution says that the president shall enforce the laws passed by Congress. It does not say he can make laws or that he can choose which laws to enforce and which not to. It certainly doesn't say that he can change laws on his own. Yet the president has already done that at least 30 times to Obamacare. He's issued 27 executive orders regarding gun control, which he has no constitutional right to do. And one of the most recent of those is basically amending the HIPAA Act. Now, HIPAA is the federal law that requires our privacy of our medical records to be respected, that our medical records cannot be given out without our permission. They cannot be transferred from one government agency to another without our permission, and they can't be used against us without our permission. Obama says, no, I'm changing that law. From now on, I want the states to actively look through medical records and to take those records, and if there is anything in there about people being depressed or people ever being diagnosed with PTSD, or even talking about the fact that they were depressed at some point, if they had taken certain medications, such as if you were a child, you had medications for ADD or ADHD, and there's an alarming group of adults being put on the medications for ADHD now. If you were ever in that category, your name will go on the list of people who cannot purchase firearms in this country. You will be declared mentally incompetent to the point of being a danger to yourself or others, and you will go on that list. It's happening. It's part of the pattern. It's part of the process to disarm the American public and to make us basically slaves to our own government. The broadening of the mental illness criteria is going to lead to more and more people being picked up in the middle of the night and taken away. People who oppose Obama, people who oppose what's happening, it's going to start happening to them. Another thing with the USCIS has recently done is we're in the process of filing Freedom of Information Act requests to the NSA. We want to know about the spying program. We want to know specifics. If you want to help us out on some that sort of thing, then please go to usjf.net and send us a donation. We're struggling right now. We're a small group, but we're a group that moves out and wins cases. We're a group that fights on all fronts when it comes to the Constitution. So we need your help. So please get involved. usjf.net. And if you're a veteran, please let us know about that, and particularly if you've been affected by what's going on with the VA. If you want to keep up with things on my blog and when I write where I write about constitutional issues, go to www.michaelconnelly.jigsy.com. There you can keep up with my blog. You can see the books I've written. And by the way, the book The Mortarman about my dad's unit during World War II is also in the top 1% of sales of e-books of all types on Amazon. It's selling remarkably well and getting rave reviews. And then my book, Abigail, my patriotic novel, The Story of America, is also selling quite well. And then I had the two other books, Riders in the Sky, The Ghosts and Legends of Philmont Scout Ranch, and America's Liveliest Ghost, which are basically campfire-type stories. You can see those, about how to order those on my website. And you can also order copies of my booklet, Our Constitution, which takes over your article section and amendment of the Constitution and prints it the way they were originally written and then puts my comments about it. You are on the third printing of that booklet. Again, thank you for listening today. Thanks to my guest, Alan Clark. I'll have him on again in the near future to talk more, and I look forward to talking to you next week.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.